This is VOA News reporting by remote. I'm Michael Brown. U.S. President Joe Biden on Thursday ordered tighter regulation of some weapons and pressed Congress to renew the country's long-expired ban on assault weapons. With relatives of those killed in school shootings watching on at the White House Rose Garden, the president called American gun violence an epidemic and an international embarrassment. Biden offered his proposals after several high-profile deadly shootings in the states of Georgia and Colorado. Among the proposals, Biden directed the Justice Department to issue a proposed rule to stop the proliferation of what law enforcement officials call ghost guns, handmade firearms that don't have serial numbers, making it difficult for police to track their owners when the weapons are used to commit crimes. Under Biden's proposals, the White House said the weapons would be covered by regulations in the National Firearms Act, which would require registration. Lawmakers have repeatedly talked about gun violence, but failed to agree on measures to curb it. The U.S. banned the assault weapons from 1994 to 2004, but the law was not renewed when it expired. Most adults will need a permit to carry, will not need a permit, rather, to carry a handgun in the U.S. state of Tennessee anymore. A new law, which takes effect July 1st, allows adults 21 and older and military members between 18 and 20 to carry a handgun either openly or concealed without first clearing a background check and training. The law does make exceptions for people with certain mental illnesses and criminal convictions, and it does not apply to long guns. The governor signed the measure into law, tweeting, "It shouldn't be hard for law-abiding citizens to exercise their constitutional Second Amendment rights to bear arms." This is VOA News. Health officials in the U.S. state of North Carolina said on Thursday they stopped administering Johnson & Johnson's doses at a mass vaccination site in the capital, Raleigh, and at two clinics in other towns. At least 26 people experienced adverse reactions, including fainting. Wake County authorities announced Thursday evening 18 of the more than 2,300 people vaccinated experienced adverse reactions. Four people were taken to the hospital for further examination, and the state and federal health officials are reviewing the matter. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention noted that reactions like fainting are not uncommon after someone is vaccinated, though it is reviewing reports of adverse reactions in North Carolina and three other states. In Colorado on Wednesday, 11 people saw adverse reactions after receiving a Johnson & Johnson shot. Two of those individuals were hospitalized. Australia and the Philippines limited use of the AstraZeneca vaccine on Thursday, while the African Union dropped plans to buy the shot. The Philippines suspended the use of AstraZeneca's shot for people below 60 after Europe's regulators said on Wednesday it found rare cases of blood clots among some adult recipients, although the vaccine's advantages still outweighed its risk. Australia recommended those 50 and under get Pfizer's candidate in preference to AstraZeneca. The African Union says it's now exploring options, with Johnson & Johnson having dropped plans to buy AstraZeneca's vaccine from India Serum Institute. AstraZeneca's vaccine is by far the cheapest and most high-volume launch so far and has none of the extreme refrigeration requirements of some other COVID-19 vaccines, making it likely to be the mainstay of many vaccination programs in the developing world. A medical examiner testifying Thursday that George Floyd died from a lack of oxygen as he was being pinned face down on the pavement by a former Minneapolis police officer, Derek Chauvin, who was charged in Floyd's death. In the ninth day of Chauvin's trial in the U.S. state of Minnesota, the testimony undercuts the defense contention that Floyd, an African-American, died from his use of illegal drugs and underlying medical conditions and not from Chauvin's actions. Chauvin, who is white, has pleaded not guilty to murder and manslaughter charges in the case being heard by a racially diverse jury. For more news, please join us at our website, voanews.com. I'm Michael Brown reporting by remote, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, April 9th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Southern African leaders call for an immediate technical deployment to Mozambique.
What we have here is a human rights and humanitarian crisis that has left hundreds of thousands displaced, insecure, and unable to return to their homes.
Somali elections remain on hold after latest political talks collapse. Commercial trucks refuse to enter South Sudan due to insecurity. Tanzania's government trims back president's order to reopen media outlets. And WHO says some African countries are left behind in the race for COVID-19 vaccine.
Countries such as Benin, Comoros, Liberia, Sierra Leone, and South Sudan have faced delays in rolling out vaccines due to constraints around funding, planning, and human resource shortages.
And a Kenyan charity makes vegetable soup for the poor. Those stories plus Samson Omali's sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Leaders from six Southern African nations met yesterday, Thursday, in Maputo to figure out how to address a rise in violent extremist attacks in Mozambique's volatile north, including a sophisticated attack last month that threatened the nation's gas reserves. VOA's Anita Powell looks at what is at stake.
Here is the puzzle the presidents of Botswana, Malawi, Mozambique, South Africa, Tanzania, and Zimbabwe are trying to solve. A shadowy insurgency has taken a stranglehold over northern Mozambique, increasing their violent attacks in recent months and endangering the nation's large gas reserves. On Thursday, after 2 days of meetings between regional military and security officials and heads of state, the Southern African Development Community's top six leaders called for an immediate technical deployment to Mozambique ahead of another high-level meeting at the end of April. Legally, the body can intervene militarily in cases of intrastate conflict like this one. But Mozambique has so far been unreceptive. The latest chapter in this violent three-year saga, an attack last month by Islamic State-linked insurgents on the city of Palma, close to a multi-billion-dollar French gas project, appears to have been the final straw that motivated leaders to convene. In that highly organized attack, militants laid waste to the small seaside town and committed horrific atrocities, according to rights groups. It is a complex story, but rights groups say leaders need to focus on one issue. Fundamentally, they argue, this is a human rights crisis. Dewa Mavinga is Southern Africa Director for Human Rights Watch.
What we have here is a human rights and humanitarian crisis that has left hundreds of thousands displaced, insecure, and unable to return to their homes because of the attacks that have been ongoing. So the lack of security then spills over to affect everything else, including in terms of stability and economic programs that might be taking place in Cabo Delgado. As we have seen with the attack on Palma Town, it then disrupted all socioeconomic activities. But at the core of it is a lack of protection in terms of the rights of the citizens who were then forced to flee to Tanzania and southwards to Pemba.
The United Nations estimates 1.3 million people need urgent humanitarian assistance and that 670,000 have been pushed out of their homes by the violence. Historian Yusuf Adam, a retired professor at Maputo's Eduardo Mondlane University, told VOA the problems in this region go back way beyond the start of the insurgency in 2017. He's been studying the region since the 1970s and says he's documented growing animus in the last two decades between local landowners, who are mostly Muslim, and farmers, who are mostly Christian. He believes Mozambique's government waited too long to try to address these divides, and perhaps more importantly, to tackle the area's systemic poverty and inequality. And for that reason, he says, a military solution is no solution.
There is no military solution. People have to be heard and things have to be negotiated. And also people's the right to land. People have to benefit also from whatever is coming out from this mining, oil, petrol and gas operations.
While militants have committed grievous acts, including rapes and beheadings, rights groups have also documented abuses by Mozambican security forces, including torture and extrajudicial killings. In their communique, Southern African leaders did not say what exactly an immediate technical deployment means, what exactly it would do, or even how soon they could get their feet on the ground. nor did they elaborate on their statement that such heinous attacks cannot be allowed to continue without a proportionate regional response. SADC will meet again in Maputo on April 28th. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Elections in Somalia, already delayed for months, remain on hold after another round of talks between top political leaders failed this week. Mohamed Kahir reports from Mogadishu on how Somalis feel about the standoff and what's likely to happen next.
Somalia's federal government said on Wednesday that efforts to resolve the stalemate on elections collapsed after leaders from the states of Puntland and Jubaland failed to agree on the way forward. But the leaders from both states rejected that claim from the Information Minister Osman Dube, saying in a joint statement that the administration of President Mohamed Abdullahi Farmajo is not ready for the polls. Residents of the capital, Mogadishu, seem frustrated by the continued disagreement among the political stakeholders in the country. Bukhari Amin remains hopeful the crisis can be resolved. He says the interest of the general public rests on the urgent end of the ongoing talks on the polls and conducting transparent, peaceful elections in the Horn of African nation. He adds that continued difference between the political leaders on holding democratic elections will jeopardize the hard-earned stability in the country. The presidential and parliamentary elections were originally scheduled to begin late last year. Farmajo's term officially expired in February, and some opposition leaders insist he is no longer the president, further complicating the talks. Political science teacher at Somali National University, Anwar Abdul Fattah, says lack of trust among the Somali leaders is the main obstacle to holding the elections.
There are several reasons which caused this fiasco. Lack of goodwill is one of them, because both sides were engaging to defeat each other instead of focusing the gist of the issue. Second, there is a degree of recklessness among the Somali politicians, because all Somali people were waiting the result of the talks. But yesterday, both sides were delivering wealth of information and started demonizing each other.
The international community has repeatedly urged Somali leaders to resolve their issues, but diplomacy analyst Mohamed Dugo says the ball is now in the global partners' court to take necessary action against stubborn leaders. He says Somali citizens expect the international community to take a decisive role through intervention since leaders failed to agree on the polls. He added that, in order to safeguard the progress made in the democracy and stability of the country, the international community intervention in Somalia's ongoing talks on polls is inevitable. The UN office in Somalia, the US and the European Union have appealed to Somali leaders to resolve their differences in the spirit of the holy month of Ramadan. Mohamed Kahir for VOA News in Mogadishu, Somalia.
Hundreds of commercial trucks carrying goods bound for South Sudan have stopped at the borders this week, with drivers refusing to complete deliveries due to insecurity. A series of armed attacks on vehicles in South Sudan last month left at least 15 people dead. The truckers say they won't leave Uganda and Kenya until their safety can be guaranteed. Winnie Sirino reports from South Sudan's capital, Juba.
David Kirotho Mathinde, chairman of the Kenyan Drivers Association, said attacks on roads linking Juba to the towns of Nimule and Yei have claimed lives of several foreign truck drivers in recent months. He said no truck will leave for South Sudan if the government does not provide security along the roads.
You see, these guys have been hijacking people. Not only hijacking people, but killing drivers. It has given us a very hard time. We are not happy. If the government of Sudan is not going to take any action about those people who are killing our drivers, then definitely even our bosses, we are going to discuss this issue with the government, with our government, and make sure that no person will enter that country. Not even a driver will never enter that country, because we do work with the respect, and that's why we are working even we go into dangerous zones.
Mathinde said drivers often put their lives on the line to deliver food to countries like South Sudan and Congo, which struggle with food insecurity, and that it's not fair that they are being targeted. He said the association has asked South Sudan's government several times to boost security, but nothing much has ever been done. All the drivers want, he said, is protection.
Let them make sure that we have full support of security from border to the end of the last destination of dropping their goods. Let them make sure that we have the last solution and forever. No driver should be killed. No goods should be stolen.
Colonel Santo Domich, deputy spokesperson for South Sudan People's Defense Forces, said the chief of staff has implemented plans to provide security on the major roads leading to Juba.
It was resolved in the SSPDF strategic security meeting that the forces along the road from Juba to Nimuli, as well as from Juba to Yei Kaya, have to be reinforced, and they have already been reinforced since last Friday. And the forces are there. We are going to locate a lot of detaches along those roads. And of course, it is impossible to close all the roads from with the military, but we are going to close all those gaps either by foot patrol or mechanized patrol.
Domit said the army will make sure that the roads are safe for the movement of all commercial trucks and for humanitarian operations. Daniel Ding, an official in charge of border agents in the town of Nimule, say there are about 3,000 trucks currently parked on the Uganda side of the border. He said if the standoff continues, prices of fuel and food in South Sudan may start to rise because the landlocked country is dependent on goods transported through its neighbors. Winnie Sirino for VOA News, Juba, South Sudan.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, April 9th. Earlier this week, new Tanzanian President Samia Hassan announced that media outlets shut down under her predecessor could reopen. Now, the chief government spokesperson said yesterday that the president was only referring to online television. As Charles Kumbe reports from Dar es Salaam, journalists are confused and not very happy with the new administration.
This week, Tanzanian journalists applauded an announcement from President Samia Hassan that media organizations suspended under the late President John Magufuli will be allowed to reopen. But a day later, the mood has changed, as the newly appointed government spokesperson clarified that Hassan's announcement applied only to online television outlets. Neville Mena is a secretary for Tanzania Editors Forum. He says it appears that the Ministry of Information is disobeying the president's order. He says that earlier, in his press release about the president's event, the government spokesperson wrote that among the directives that the president made was to reopen all suspended media outlets. Later, he came out and reversed what he has written. In my opinion, Mena says, this contradiction was created by the same people who were there in the Ministry of Information for a long time under the leadership of the late John Magufuli. He says these are the same people who participated in denying licenses to media outlets. Isambura is an assistant lecturer in the School of Journalism at the University of Dar es Salaam.
So la kwanza nilojiuliza, tunaogopa nini? Yani, kwa nini?
He says the first question I asked myself was that, what do we fear? Why were the statement and the order given out by the person in the top position later being clarified by someone with a lower position? Information Minister Innocent Bashungwa said the government is willing to meet with owners of still suspended media outlets and discuss the path to reopening.
Na kama kuna case by case kwa upande wa tasnia za habari nyingine.
Bashungwa says if there are case-by-case situations with other media outlets, they should go to his office to discuss the issue. He says that if there is another media outlet that wants to reopen besides online television, there are reasons for their suspension. The laws were used to come up with the decision, and I believe the law has also given out guidelines to what should be done if those media outlets need to return to work. Rights activists say there is no partial freedom of the press and it should be granted fully. As things stand now, Kwanza TV, an outlet owned by government critic Maria Sarungi, will be allowed to reopen, while four newspapers closed by Magufuli's government remain closed. Charles Kombe, for VOA News, Dar es Salaam, Tanzania.
The World Health Organization says Africa's rollout of the COVID-19 vaccine is being hampered by supply shortages and delays in planned deliveries. To date, the WHO reports 4.3 million cases of COVID-19 in Africa, including 114,000 deaths. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
A few countries are bucking the trend and making good progress in immunizing their populations against the deadly coronavirus. The World Health Organization says Morocco has purchased 8.7 million doses of vaccine and has administered more shots to its population than any other African country. It adds a few other countries, notably Ghana, Rwanda, and Angola, also have distributed a significant proportion of their vaccine within a short time. However, WHO Regional Director for Africa, Machidiso Moeti, says more than 1 billion Africans still have not been able to avail themselves of the life-saving tool. She says Africa has administered only 2% of the more than 600 million doses of COVID-19 vaccine that has been dispensed globally.
10 African countries that have carried out the most vaccinations have now used up over two-thirds of the supplies that they've received. At the same time, countries such as Benin, Comoros, Liberia, Sierra Leone, and South Sudan have faced delays in rolling out vaccines due to constraints around funding, planning, and human resource shortages.
In another setback, Moeti says delays in COVAX shipments are expected to continue this month because India is fighting a severe second wave of COVID-19. As a consequence, she says India, which is a major manufacturer of the AstraZeneca vaccine, has temporarily banned exports. The European Medicines Agency Wednesday announced a possible link between the AstraZeneca vaccine and unusual blood clots with low platelets. Despite that, Moeti says she would welcome delivery of that vaccine as soon as it is available.
While concerning, the events under assessment are very rare, we'd like to emphasize. Almost 200 million individuals have received this vaccine around the world, and cases of blood clots and low platelets are extremely low, with less than 100 events reviewed in Europe.
Of greater concern, she says, is the unequal distribution of life-saving vaccine, which is largely available in wealthy countries and scarce in poor countries. To help right that wrong, Moeti says high-income countries should share their surplus supplies of vaccine with other less fortunate countries. By doing that, she acknowledges all countries will be sharing the risks. At the same time, she says they will minimize the emergence of further variants of the coronavirus and show solidarity in defeating the devastating disease. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In Eswatini, formerly Swaziland, the People's Democratic Movement, PUDEMO, says the government has been too slow in carrying out vaccinations to contain the spread of the coronavirus. It also said it appears the administration in Mbabane does not have the funds to purchase additional vaccines, despite financial assistance from international partners. The government has denied the accusations. Mulongisi Makanya is the president of PUDEMO. He tells VOA's Peter Clotty that without donations of vaccine from international partners, the Eswatini government will be unable to vaccinate the population.
PUDEMO wants to condemn unequivocally the depressingly slow pace of vaccination. The real reason behind it, Peter, is the fact that Swaziland, as it stands now, has absolutely no money, because every little money that the country gets spent and taken by the king and his family, who continue to lead a lavish lifestyle. Because if you look at the vaccines that we are using to vaccinate our people, even at the present moment, all of them are donated vaccines. donated by countries such as Taiwan, donated by the European Union, and some from the COVAX facility of the African Union. This is exactly why we are urging our people to see that we need to stand up and confront this oppressive regime that has condemned us into a life of beggars and a life of poverty.
Pamulengisi, some people are suggesting that the government on several occasions launched a series of education campaigns to educate the masses to embrace COVID-19 protocols, including social distancing, hand washing, and face covering. And a lot of Eswatinis are doing that. So this, they said, forms part of the effort to stop the spread of the disease. Why do you think the government is still not doing enough?
We want to thank our people for showing the responsibility that we are talking about of adhering to all the non-pharmaceutical protocols of preventing the contraction of this deadly virus. However, we must say, Peter, that it is not because of the education that government has really rolled out, but it is largely because, you know, when our people are faced with a life-threatening disaster, it is always almost come as a second nature for people to try and adapt so as to avoid contracting the virus.
Mulungisi Makanya is the president of PUDEMO. You are speaking with VS Peter Clote from the Eswatini capital, Mbabane. Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with the CAF Champions League, as the last round of the CAF Champions League group stage will get on the way this Friday, with three vacant places in the tournament's quarterfinals still to be decided. Only five teams have guaranteed their qualification for the next round of the elite club competition, with Simba SC of Tanzania with 13 points and title holders of Al Ahly of Egypt on 8 points, having secured the two qualifying spots for Group A. In Group B, CR Belouizdad will meet Mamelodi Sundowns of South Africa in the last round at home, while Al Hilal will be hosted by TP Mazembe in the must-win battle. In Group C, Wydad Casablanca of Morocco have guaranteed their place in the quarterfinals, but is still uncertain whether they will qualify as a group winner or as the second-placed team. Wydad are now top of Group C with 10 points, while the second qualifying spot is still up for grabs, with both Horoya of Guinea and Kaizer Chiefs of South Africa battling for it in the last round, as both sides are leveled on 8 points. Zamalek of Egypt, who were runners-up in last year's edition, must win their game against Tunisia on Saturday to confirm their quarterfinal slot, while MC Alger have to lose against Group D leaders Esperance Sportive. Cameroon women will this weekend continue their quest to qualify for the Tokyo 2020 Olympics Women's Football Tournament when they face Chile in the CAF CONMEBOL Intercontinental Playoff doubleheader on the 10th and 13th of April in Antalya, Turkey. The Indomitable Lionesses missed earning an automatic ticket to Tokyo after losing to Zambia on away goals despite the 4-4 aggregate in the final round of the CAF qualifying series in March 2020. Cameroon saw off Ethiopia, DR Congo and Cote d'Ivoire before losing to Zambia, who will have their Olympic Games debut this summer. In Botswana, Botswana Football Association has announced the appointment of Mrs. Gabwane Taylor as the Chief Executive Officer and Secretary General of the organization. Mrs. Taylor is the first woman to occupy such a position since the inception of the association. She officially took office on the 5th of April on a 3-year contract. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. And that's it for this Friday, April 9th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.